Confusion is nothing new. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that is the amazing Cassandra Wilson. She was born on this day in 1955. Hear more of her music during the breaks. One of my favorite singers of all time, and happy birthday. She just brings joy to my ears every time you hear her voice. Well, we'll see if this conversation brings joy to your ears as we look at what's happening in this city and in cities around America, starting with Detroit, but looking at Baltimore. In our roundtable today, we have with us here in the studio Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of the Beautiful Struggle, Krishana Davis, reporter for the Baltimore Sun Media Group, covering news, politics, and more in Harford County, and Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of the Healthcare for the Homeless, now an instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you.
Number is 410-319-8888, and yes, we will take your calls. I apologize not getting to you in the last segment, but Kevin and Paul had so much to say about Fred Hampton, I wanted to let them finish their thoughts. I apologize if you called in. Couldn't get through, but get through now, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. I'll check there to see if you have anything to say. Tweet at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So let me just start by this. There was this morning, the news was all over the news, starting last night, that Detroit, the judge in Detroit, Judge Stephen Rhodes, made it clear that public employee pensions were not to be protected in the federal Chapter 9 bankruptcy, even though the Michigan Constitution says they are protected, and that these pension benefits, the quote is, pension benefits are a contractual right and are not entitled to any heightened protection in a municipal bankruptcy. Now, there are cities across America that are facing all kinds of debt. Now, we don't know the billions it is in Baltimore. It means I don't know at the moment. But what the pension obligations are for city employees, what they are for state employees. But you know, as many commentators have written in the New York Times and other places, since this ruling, that leaders across the country, political leaders, are kind of waiting to see how this can affect them and what they can do to cut that financial burden away from states and cities, meaning that people who are in their 60s and people who are your parents and grandparents could be losing their pensions. People who are your age will never have those pensions. Right? I'm looking across the room with the two younger people here and two older people on the other side of the room. And it's not a generational war because we're not the enemy here. Nor do we have pensions. I don't have a pension. That's why I'm working now. But let's talk about that. What do we think does this portend, Jeff Singer?
Oh, you're entirely correct. This portends a continuation of the assault on workers and the assault on cities. We have a 50, 60-year history of this in this nation. The demonization of unions, for example. The assault against unions and the popular assault, the manufacturing of the consent about how evil unions are, is part of this story. And another part of the story is the assault against the urban sector, against cities. America has no urban policy except to destroy cities and the homes in them. I mean, we've seen that in Baltimore, right? We have 46,000 vacant houses. The city just announces that they're using their mortgage settlement to tear those houses down rather than to rehabilitate them for the thousands of people who are sleeping on the streets. So all of this is part of the same story.
Davon, how do you see this as affecting Baltimore and beyond?
Well, I think it speaks to kind of a large phenomenon. It reminds me of, you know, folks who are familiar with some of the neoliberal policies of the IMF and the World Bank, the way that financial institutions control how government entities, you know, spend money. And that what you'll find, you know, in countries around the world that are mostly populated with people of color is that financial big financial institutions oftentimes, you know, provide monies to, you know, particular countries based on their expenditures of public resources, spending those resources on contracts for big corporations and not public services to help the people. And so it really reminds me, when you think of the way that cities are treated in the United States that are, you know, populated largely with peoples of color, you find that I was once at a budget hearing in City Hall where the finance director was explaining the expenditures of the city government having a lot to do with what will help protect the bond rating that is determined by financial institutions. And it was interesting because on one hand, the expenditures on money for cleaning up the big blizzard that happened in 2010 was seen as an acceptable expenditure. But the expenditures on crossing guards wasn't considered, you know, a responsible enough expenditure that the financial institutions that govern, you know, our bond rating that allows us to borrow, you know, didn't see those things as acceptable or productive expenditures. And so it's important for us to understand that there's a bigger industry around how cities spend money. And if you look at, you know, the bankruptcy in Detroit, I think it has everything to do with the way that public resources are oftentimes used by financial institutions to pad the wealth of those that are already in control of the major institutions that affect cities in the United States.
I think if you kind of think back to earlier this year, there was a study that was done by a consulting firm, I believe, in Philadelphia that named Baltimore and a couple of other cities across the country that were looking at a long-term view that they could be possibly become bankrupt. And so the mayor kind of proposed this, you know, this 10-year plan where she's going to implement certain policies to try to cut down on spending in Baltimore, and therefore hopefully we won't reach that point. And one of the things that came up then was the 401k plans for a lot of the city workers. So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see in Baltimore if because no one wants to have to deal with this pension issue in Baltimore. And I think that the mayor and the city council are going to try to do as much as they can to try to alleviate some of that debt ahead of time so that that isn't the issue in Baltimore, so that we don't have to worry about going through bankruptcy. So it'll be interesting to see if the mayor can cut out enough of the spending going forward, as well as the city council and other agencies, so that that's not the issue. Because as we can see in Baltimore, that trend towards bankruptcy is on the horizon.
If
ahead,
I might,
Jeff,
I would urge your listeners to read Demos's new report on the bankruptcy of Detroit.
Demos,
you know, the liberal think tank.
Right.
But it's
liberal
a,
financiers like George Soros and the rest it, from it, right, right, right.
Indeed. But it's written by a banker, Wallace Turbeville. And he shows that the bankruptcy of Detroit has nothing to do with the pension issues. The pensions, yes, there may be about $3.5 billion of pensions that aren't sufficiently funded. But that's not why Detroit's declaring bankruptcy. They have a cash shortfall because their property tax and income tax revenues are down, because their unemployment is high, and the city's been depopulated like most northern, you know, industrial cities. They have something less than $198 million deficit, and they need to deal with that. But that doesn't have much to do with pensions. It does have a lot to do with the giveaways of the city to the corporate sector in development, because the city of Detroit, like the city of Baltimore and most other cities, gives lots of its tax dollars to enrich developers rather than to help the ordinary people in the city. And the Demos report recommends that they take a look at these giveaways, take that money back. Also, there's a lot of money going to Wall Street for these very strange credit default swaps that the city's entered into over the years. If they took all that money back, they'd have very little debt currently, and they could deal with these problems of the pension later.
And this is interesting. Let's explore this for a moment before we talk about the homelessness issue and the money that the federal government wants to back from Baltimore City. Because what you're describing, what Jeff is describing, Demos, is a liberal, huge capitalist think tank where people come together, like George Soros and some of them, and some of the more progressive liberal ends of that capitalist class, to think about what the future is. And so what they're saying literally is they're trying to figure out a way to save capitalism from itself, because right now that system that we think of corporate capitalism is not answering the questions of everyday people's lives.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at the issue of debt and cities being in debt, you know, I think it's important to understand that much of what we call money in debt is illusory. You know, much of it, you know, are machinations that are put forward by, you know, major corporate or financial institutions to pad their wealth. And I think it's important also to keep in mind that when you think of, you know, the importance of you know, economic development in cities, that a big part of the strategy has to do with public dollars, like Jeff said, public dollars going to corporate industry. And what's fascinating is that, you know, you talk about pensions being cut, you know, because, you know, it's, you know, as far as this judge has determined, you know, it's important in order to help, you know, balance the books and get Detroit out of bankruptcy. But what was problematic is that, you know, I think there's a willingness to, you know, to take money or to regulate money, you know, more strictly when it comes to poor folks, particularly people of color, than it is when you talk about, you know, big developers that, you know, oftentimes get waivers on the minority business quotas. That get waivers in terms of local hirings or incentives for local hiring to get waived. You know, there are all these things that, you know, big corporate interests are allowed to sidestep, you know. But when it comes to working people and people of color, you know, there's this microscope on, you know, where's the money going and, you know, why are we giving all this money? And I think it's important that we kind of investigate the collective American consciousness that would allow, you know, what we see in Detroit to seem to a lot of people to make a lot of sense. I think that logic needs to be interrogated.
I think this could be we can see this kind of wave rolling because already the mayors of Stockton, California, and other small cities in California are saying now they can do the same thing. That was also part of the New York Times story this morning in the inside pages. And I think you're going to see more and more of that. And I can see that kind of conversation happening here in Baltimore. I can see it happening in Washington, D.C., happening all across the country, you know, and I think this is. I'm curious what our listeners think. You want to jump in, Krishan, before we go, listeners? 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts on this? And then we're going to talk a bit about the $9.5 million that the federal government says were not spent or not followed correctly. And some of the organizations that are saying did not follow it correctly, file correctly, and follow the money are actually some organizations doing the best work in the city. So there's some contradictions there as well, like Prisoners Aid. And the Public Justice Center. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, Mark, I was going to comment on the last topic, but I'm going to move on. So now you're talking about that the corporate interests are conspiring against people of color. So, and the status quo, it doesn't do anything. Let me remind you what's going on. You know what the status quo is? The mayor is black. The city council president is black. The majority of the council members are black. What indeed a lot, and particularly the mayor, regularly supports a lot of corporate interests like Exxon, like Harbor Point.
That's right.
Always supports these so-called corporations and supports a lot of the policies and legislation that suppose you say is conspiring against only people of color, but yet who's in charge? Who's the status quo? Why isn't the mayor looking out for more of the interests of the homeless? Why isn't she talking about more low-income housing instead of kissing the butts of all the developers? She's part of the problem. She's black, and apparently maybe she's not looking out for the interests of people of
color.
All right.
Thank you, Bruce. And I think that, let me just say, first of all, I never use the word conspiracy during this conversation. I'm not a big conspiracy theorist. But let's wrestle with the point he raised here. I think that when you come to power in corporations, on the one hand, what affects working class people, no matter what race, and what affects community of color, is separate from who is sitting in power and who they answer to and who influences them because of the politics of the city and what powers developers have. I mean, you saw Heather Mazier, her interesting campaign announcement yesterday was that she's going to take public funding. She's not going to take private corporate funding for her campaign. She's only going to take public funding.
The first since 1994, I believe.
Right, exactly. Which is, I find it. So, I mean, that raises this all. To me, this all ties together. I don't think Dave Bonin pushes, and you can start if you like. But I don't think it makes any difference whether the mayor, this Baltimore, is African American or Latino or white or whatever they are, as long as there are certain interests that kind of control what moves the city.
There are general things that affect working people, you know, poor people, regardless of race. It's, you know, there's certainly elements that affect folks, you know, that are poor and working class. I think it's important, though, that when we talk about, you know, power, that there are not independent black institutions that wield power and resources in Baltimore or in many places around the United States. And so the lack of independent black institutions, and this isn't, you know, exclusively just black folks, but I'm saying just as a black person looking at a city that is majority black, that we don't have the kind of independent black institutions that are accountable to the black masses in Baltimore in order to levy the kind of power necessary for folks, regardless of what their race is the mayor or the city council, to leverage the kind of power to push forward an agenda that will address issues that affect specifically black people in Baltimore City. And I think when we look at, you know, things like the mismanagement of funding, and we look at, you know, the way that public resources are spent, that we can see that that when you look at issues that affect primarily black folks in Baltimore City, again, not exclusively, because there's certainly other issues that are important, but just for the purpose of the conversation and for the purposes of a city that's 65% to 67% black, that we don't have independent institutions to protect our interests. And I think that explains how you have people in elected office that who are black but don't have the backing financially and don't have the political power behind them to have the leverage that would be necessary to push forward things that would help black folks.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, just because over the course of history, there have been institutions that have been set up, built, and organizations to help people of color and other minorities. And so at some point, there's either a loss of consciousness or a loss of people caring about those organizations or those ideas, because to me, I think maybe people thought that after the civil rights movement that African Americans in America made it, and that, you know, they no longer needed to advocate as loudly on their behalf, or that because some people were able to go to college and because some people were able to achieve the American dream, that, you know, there was no longer a need or a struggle. So a lot of those organizations lost funding, they lost support. And so now we're kind of back where we started, let's say 50 years ago in some regards. And so I think I just wanted to be very clear in what Davon's saying. Like, I agree, but you have to look at this kind of broader spectrum of why there aren't these organizations.
And if I can add one thing really quickly, it's just that it's important that we look at something broad like integration and we look at the effect that it had. A part of the illusion of integration was that, you know, we live in a society that now cared about black folks in the condition that we're in. And what we're finding is that we need the institutions that were accountable to black folks in order to protect ourselves in ways that we thought we didn't need, but that looking at things like what happened in Detroit, that we need those institutions to protect us.
I'm going to move to the question of homelessness and get back to the phones. A lot of people are calling in. But I think another discussion we should have is, another day, would be interesting to have, is what do we mean by integration?
Right.
If we're integrating into old America, is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about trying to build an integration that is a new America that's very different? So it depends what we mean by integration, which we should have that discussion. We'll book that in the next couple of weeks. That'd be really good to have. But let me switch gears here for a moment, since in this roundtable. Then Benjamin, you're the next caller up in Columbia. We'll come right to your call, see what you have to say about bankruptcy. But Jeff, I want you to comment for a moment what this, since you started Healthcare for the Homeless as executive director and founder, former executive director, what does this mean, $9.5 million by the federal government, misuse funds for the homeless? What are we missing here?
I do have some interest in this. Healthcare for the Homeless received a large part of this money, almost $900,000. And we used it to house about 150 people. Worked pretty well. We often don't get money to house people. However, this particular program, as many government programs are, was ill-conceived and very poorly executed. No one knew what the rules were to use the money. They weren't published until the money had already been given out. It was a very complicated program to implement, and all it provided was some rent subsidies for folks who were either going to become homeless or already were for no longer than 18 months in a period when people couldn't get jobs. We ran into this situation in which we put somebody into housing knowing that no more than 18 months later they would probably become homeless again. There's a lot of controversy around that concept. Like the whole stimulus, it was way too small, poorly conceived, and poorly implemented. Having said that, yes, I know there were some organizations that didn't use the money the way they should have, but there were organizations that did use it well, and I don't think that we should focus on this relatively small issue when there are thousands and thousands of people today and tonight sleeping on the street, and the city has some responsibility that they're not accepting, aside from this money, to get people housed.
Any thoughts on this before we open the phones?
Just, you know, I think when people talk about corruption, you know, it's strange to me because there are lots of people in Baltimore and probably around the country that get paid six-figure salaries to go to meetings, right? They don't do very much, right? But just to go to meetings, right? There are organizations that get financed, right? Just because they have a friend, you know, that's on a board of a major foundation that gives them lots
I'm
of money.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you. You know that.
Right. I understand. That to do a program that was just kind of a thought experiment that they were able to do in a community that just are strapped for resources. I just always think it's important that we talk about corruption, that it's important that we think about it broadly, that there are folks who are mismanaging way larger sums of money, right, than the monies that are talked about in this story. And not that we shouldn't investigate it and not that, you know, we shouldn't find out where there is corruption. But I think it's important that there's a large level of institutionalized corruption in terms of where monies is actually going that I think it's important for us to be looking at.
To the phones. 410-319-8888. Benjamin in Columbia, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Mark. Listen, I appreciate this conversation, but as I've traveled over the country over the years, I've been in transportation for over 39 years, I've seen Philadelphia, and I've seen Trenton, New Jersey. I've seen the states that were in, the capital was taken out of the real estate. People not working, people not paying into the tax system. That's what caused bankruptcy. When in the late 60s, I believe, 67, 68, I think, might have been 69, New York was getting ready to file bankruptcy because there was a lot of people working. But it was so much slum in New York at that time that people was not really paying into the tax system because I think it was underground mob, I believe. I'm not sure. But also Michigan. There's a lot of homeless out there. There's a lot of houses that is run down because the people are not paying into the tax system. The poor the people are, they have to work and earn their money. They pay into the tax system. People are unemployed. They can't pay into the tax system because there's no jobs for them. So my point to you is this. A lot of the gentlemen is on there, they got a lot of degrees and a lot of sense, and they put it out there, but they're not tapping into the real resource. A lot of people that are locked up, they're paying money unnecessarily to the people that are putting people in jail and not letting people pay into the tax system. That's the problem with America. They got to get the people out and let them start earning their keep, pay into the tax system so when they get older, they can have something that they can lean on. God bless you, Mark. Keep on doing the good work you're doing.
Thank you, Benjamin. We take a note from Sweden that is shutting down most of the prisons in the country of Sweden. There was an announcement made. It was interesting. Another caller, then I'm going to go right to Krishana to make the first comment back. 410-319-8888. Ben in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well.
One thing I think that should change when referring to organizations or agencies that should be established in Baltimore that will look at the interest or look after the interest of African-Americans or blacks is that it should stop being referred to as a black organization because it's not doing anybody any good. It's another form of separation that I feel that the African America is putting on itself by referring to these different organizations as black organizations. And as the future goes on and they call it a melting pot, it's not going to really help people. It's just going to put you, it's going to alienate that population. So it's a simple thing to say, but hard to do. So it's just a comment that I had.
Okay.
I was wondering what your
thank you,
were.
Ben. Krishana, and then I know Devon's say as well.
Krishana. Well, first I wanted to kind of address the caller directly.
Sure.
When we talk about this melting pot, there's a book by Torrey called "Who's Afraid of Post-Racial Things?" Who's afraid of post-blackness? And we talk about this post-racial society and that we're moving towards a more melted America, but that's really not true right now at this point in time. And at some point, it may be true, but I think that there's nothing wrong with creating organizations that specifically deal with issues of certain racial groups or, women versus men or for different age groups. I don't think that there's any major issue there. But just kind of back on the topic of the mismanagement of funds or, not having audits, I think in Baltimore and a lot of cities across the country, there have been so many talks of not having audits and just not there's kind of no system set in place to look at how money is spent. And I think the more that this isn't done, that's going to keep creating this problem. We just finished talking about, this bankruptcy in Detroit, and these two issues really go hand in hand.
That's a very key point, the audit point we have to keep coming back to here.
Yeah. It's an interesting comment, and I'll tie the two together, that and the mismanagement of resources. you know, people don't ask, you know, people who are Japanese not to be Japanese. You know, people don't ask Jewish folks not to be Jewish, you know. I mean, you can have a multiracial, multicultural society, you know, and have people respect, you know, their own cultural heritage and have institutions that have fidelity to that cultural experience and to the people that are representative of that culture. And if you look at the history of the United States, that many of the ethnic groups that came to the United States established institutions on the basis of their ethnic identities, right, as a way to generate the kind of upward right. mobility that allowed many of these immigrants to integrate into mainstream American society. And so when and so to me, it's just very interesting. We talk about, you know, resources being dispensed for particular things. You know, when you talk about – because the attitude of the caller, I think, is a very well-shared – it's a widely held thought that, you know, why do we have to have black institutions? Why can't it just be American institutions? But it's important that when what happens is that then you have people who are well-intentioned but speaking for black people and about black people instead of having black people who just have a certain set of particular experiences that are unique to our, you know, experience in the United States and our global experience of white supremacy around the world, that it's important for us to be able to speak on our own behalf. And for some reason, and I say for some reason, knowing what the reason is, but for some reason, you know, when black folks do that, it generates this kind of fear. You know, it generates, you know, a bunch of anxieties. But I think it's important that when we talk about how resources are spent and how we allocate, you know, in terms of public policy as well, that we can, in the conversation, insert the idea that communities that are most directly affected by issues that many service organizations are trying to address, that the primary goal is to empower the people who are directly affected to be the leadership of those institutions. And in a city that's 67% black, where your poverty and, you know, housing discrimination, that black folks who are directly affected are elevated to leadership institutions that primarily serve and address issues facing black folks.
Right. And we don't ask the Irish Americans to get rid of the Hibernian Society or Jews not to have the B'nai B'rith or
right.
whatever. So,
right.
Exactly. We're going to take a brief break and come back with our panel. They're not going anywhere. We'll be joined by Nick Mosby to talk about his new legislation that has to do with employers not being allowed to ask whether or not you've been to prison or been arrested. We'll talk with him while he's introducing them, what that means. We're going to go after this break with Peaches and Regalia, Frank Zappa. He died on this day. Little Frank, also a Baltimore boy. So we'll be right back. Don't go away.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Jiggle. Uh-huh.
Bounce.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Let it bump, though.
It's a hard knock life for us. It's a hard knock life for us. Steady treat us. We get tricked. Steady kisses. We get kicked. It's a hard knock life.
From standing on the corners bopping to driving some of the hottest cars New Yorkers ever seen. Dropping some of the hottest verses rappers
this
ever
is Mark Siner. Happy birthday, Jay-Z. We're coming back with Hard Knock Life. So
I love this musical selection. Yes.
Thank my producers. They get out there and they pull out the music selections. Number here is 410-319-8888. We're still here with our three guests who like our musical selections. Krishana Davis is back with us, now reporter for the Baltimore Sun Media Group, covering news, politics, and more in Hartford County. Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Jeff Singer, Founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless and also an instructor now at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. The number here is 410-319-8888. Clarence, going to come to your call next, but let us bring to the table here for a moment Councilman Nick Mosby, who is going to talk a bit. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a bit about this legislation. This is the no, what's it called? No Black Box? No...
Oh, it's ban the box.
Ban the box. Ban the box.
Yes, sir.
So talk about ban the box.
Yeah, so ban the box is it's just a piece of legislation. You know, currently today, you know, jobs is a major issue, specifically in the city of Baltimore. And unfortunately, Baltimore is home to a lot of ex-offenders and a lot of folks who have been convicted, rightfully or wrongfully so, in the past of crimes. And in today's culture, a lot of times when you go and you fill out an application to receive a job, One of the main questions is, have you ever been convicted of a crime? So folks have to check the box or have to basically communicate that they have. And unfortunately, through the vetting process of even going into like a first round of an interview, many job or employers will basically throw out or push to the side all the applications where that box has been checked. Then if you are an individual who are applying for a job and you decide not to check the box because you understand and know that this is kind of the culture and the kind of attitude towards when you check the box, so you decide not to, and you go through the interview process and you do a good job, and they do a background check, they see that you haven't necessarily lied or you haven't been forthcoming with all the information, and they kind of, you know, bring in your character, and then that's also elimination to get a particular job. So you're kind of forced to check that box, and you're forced to go down this pipeline. This piece of legislation just basically says, let's equal out the playing field, you know, at the onset of someone trying to get a job. Let's allow someone's experiences, expertise, and their abilities to kind of go in, fill out the application, take part in a interview process, and ultimately put them on a level playing field with potentially getting this job before the employer knows of any of their background history. Now, that doesn't preclude an employer from running a background check at that point to determine anything, but it does try to equal the playing field so folks will have the full advantage of trying to take part in an open, you know, job selection process.
Thought or question on this, Krishana?
You know what's interesting is if you look at America versus a lot of other countries, America is kind of one of these countries where, you know, once you have been convicted of a crime, once you've been to jail, you're tainted, even if you've served your time, versus a lot of other countries, which will allow people to go back to work and kind of just, you know, continue their lives after they've served their time. But I think it's really interesting, and the legislation is a little radical for a place like Baltimore, because if you remember a couple of months ago, there was this study from the ACLU about, you know, more blacks being arrested for marijuana. And so I remember one of the policy directors from the ACLU really saying that, you know, these small convictions are hurting young black people in cities across the country because they aren't able to, they have to check this box now, and they are considered, you know, people who have been to jail and their history is tainted a little bit. So I think that this could kind of help open the doors for, you know, more progressive and more progress and more jobs for blacks.
What about the I'm sure there must be opposition from the business community in this bill saying that we have to know who we're hiring, right?
Yeah, and once again, the bill doesn't preclude you from knowing who you're hiring. It just levels out the playing field at the onset of allowing you to basically legally just weigh someone's qualifications to the criteria of the job. And if I qualify, if I should, you know, based off of my qualifications, get an opportunity to fight for the job. Because many times we know that, you know, you look at a resume, you look at an application, that's totally different than sitting down, talking to that individual, and kind of seeing what the individual brings to the table for a particular job. So this allows for further penetration into the employment process for folks who have had, you know, criminal backgrounds or things in their background. And like Krishan said, you know, I have a very close friend who, you know, committed a crime when he was 17. He was charged as an adult. He was convicted as an adult. He's never served a day in a penitentiary or jail regarding this particular crime, and it haunts him today at the age of 36. And, you know, that story, you know, goes on and on and on and on in every sector of the city of Baltimore.
By tens of thousands.
And then you look at nonviolent convictions like Krishan is talking about regarding marijuana possession charges, and you look at the way that that has plagued, you know, our entire community. And she's right. You know, the ACLU came out with that report that said in Maryland, you know, we were fourth as it relates to those prosecutions. And then it's an unprecedented number as it looks at the disparities associated with young African-American males to their peers.
Praise to Councilman Mosby for introducing this. We worked on this at the state level for years and finally had it adopted this year. So the state no longer on its applications has the box. It's been banned.
But they can still ask the questions, right?
Well, during the interview,
right,
they can, sure.
Right.
And it was quite revealing when, as we were lobbying the legislators, some of them very readily revealed their sort of racist assumptions of why they opposed banning the box. But nonetheless, we got it adopted, and it would be hard to imagine that the Baltimore City Council wouldn't be as progressive as the General Assembly.
Yeah, and this goes further than
this
is not city employees. This is interjecting into the private sector of so you know, no no matter what company you are, if you are you know, based in Baltimore, if you're hiring for a employment in the city of Baltimore, this is what this speaks to. And you know, it's a little stronger than what you kind of said, because you, based off the way it's currently written, you cannot ask someone of their criminal background during the first interview. So this is to get someone and to make that level playing field, like I said, through the application process and through the first interview. So, you know, it will, if this goes into effect, if this passes, it'll be the right of the potential employee, you know, to not have to answer any questions around any
right.
criminal past.
Let's open the phones back up here. We can only hope that maybe the next step will be to stop locking up so many people.
Yeah.
And people of color. It might go a long way to making a better society as well.
I totally agree, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Join us. Write to us at SteinerShow @gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to Facebook. Let's go to Clarence in Baltimore. Clarence, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. I'm not sure whether this will make any sense to Mr. Mosby or to any of your guests, but will you somehow later or sometime in the future preclude a positive test for marijuana from being a basis for exclusion from employment? Because, you know, a lot of people smoke marijuana as a recreational drug. So if you preclude, if you take the box out of the business, you still have the subsequent drug test in the equation. So, I mean, you know, there's a big discussion about legalization of recreational marijuana. So you're going to have to deal with that issue at some time in the future, too, won't you? Thank you.
Or else you have to get a test for martinis as well. But I think that, yeah, I think that that is a real question. I think that this whole was a totally different subject to kind of wrestle with on a different day, which we've done before, which is the whole question of legalization of marijuana, how that will change things, and the nature of marijuana as it vis-a-vis alcohol. I mean, that's, I think, another question that we should wrestle with, but I think on a different day. 410-319-8888. Shaka, you're on the air.
One love, family.
Good morning.
Shaka.
Good morning, family. How are you today?
Good. Good morning.
Speaking in general about the homeless situation, and thank you for mentioning about burning the box, because both of those relate to, if we go to the correlation of back in the day when we had Reconstruction, we had self-supporting societies. And those were black societies that were building up. And there was a reason why they banned Reconstruction. Now we look at what were the situation we're in Baltimore, as well as other cities around the country. We know that we can definitely self-support ourselves, but you got these issues where people not only can't get a job, but we also need businesses and subcontracting contracts where we can actually get back on our feet. We're not asking for a hand out. We're looking for a hand up. And I know that we can do it together if we come together and say, let's make these people accountable that are making these contracts, which is our governing bodies, per se.
Shaka, I appreciate the call. I only have to stop because we're almost out of time in this segment, because we have to move on to our next segment coming up in just a few minutes. Do we have time for this next caller? Yes, no? No, we don't. I'm sorry. So I do want to thank all of you for being here. It's been a great conversation. You all have added a lot to this to our conversations here in Baltimore this morning. Dave Von Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Always great to have you on the air with us.
Thank you.
Krishana Davis, good to have you back. It's been too long since you've been here.
I know.
Now a reporter for the Baltimore Sun Media Group in Harford County. Always great to have you in the studio.
Good to see you.
And Jeff Singer, founder and the former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless and now instructor also at the Maryland School of Social Work. Great to have your analysis and thinking here as well.
Yeah, you're very kind.
And Councilman Nick Mosby, thanks for joining us here to talk about your legislation. Good luck with it on the council.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Mark.
It's good to have you all here, and we're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back from this break, we are going to be joined by Baynard Woods, senior editor of the City Paper, talk about this week's edition, and then be talking to Eric Berryman and Bruce Nelson about their production of Reds at Everyman Theater. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You can take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown.